showed quite a number of challenges that this industry is facing. I must say that last week we were just dealing with a very serious matter, which is the issue of the current challenges faced with the mining industry, in particular the issues of job losses. And I'm sure as of today, parties have also started a process of collective bargaining. I think it will be safe to say that we hope that that process, as it proceeds, it will proceed with complete sincerity on all parties and from all parties concerned, and do all possible to find a solution that will not exacerbate the current crisis that we are faced with. I think it is incumbent upon all of us, in particular in the industry, to ensure that we contribute towards the economic development of this country, but also towards job creation and endeavor to ensure that we do everything possible to retain jobs and therefore take decisions that might be overlasting decisions rather than decisions that may have consequences quite yearly for the very same people. And therefore, I think it's important as a committee to say so. All of this, I think it is important also to congratulate the police, which I think it's, I'm not sure which part of Gauteng, which again it was reported last week that they seized quite a number of ammunition, including explosives that are being used in mines in advancing the very difficult challenge that we are faced with, which is illegal mining. And we hope that will put an end to that advance by those who practice this illegal mining. And I think it's important to appreciate that work. One issue that I hope will at some point we will find the I must say it's a very complex, I read a story which I know is another subject around problems of trade and that have led, and I don't want to say it's a very complex matter, I must say, without taking that. I think it's a matter that involves the peers and on how the allegations around unfair trade, if one may to say, must not use the word illegal, unfair trade that was very taking place. Unfortunately, it's a matter that most of us were completely unaware. It will be very difficult to input, but cited there is a former employee of the state, what is it, the diamond regulator, who unfortunately have never have been exposed to what is making the allegations, and they have never been a benefit of none of us. The point I'm saying is that now is much unfortunate that is in front of the courts, which would be very difficult to even input or impact on. But it is quite an interesting matter that I think people who are in the industry will have to follow with keen interest. But I think on that score, I'm welcoming everyone in today's meeting, and hopefully we will have a fruitful engagement. On that note, are there any apologies?
Good morning, Honorable Members and the guests. I've got apologies from Honorable Mafolo, Honorable Malema, Honorable Schmidt and Honorable Stephen. Thank you.
Okay. Honorable Mandel.
Thank you, Chairman. Good morning, honorable members, to our distinguished guests. Perhaps just to gain clarity from the Secretary, if we can advise us in terms of a prolonged apology, what happens in that regard if someone submits an apology for the whole year?
Thank you, Honorable Mandela. I have to double check. I don't have the answer as yet, but Mr. Mandela, when he forwarded his apology, he told us that he's on sick leave up until the 13th of June. So his apology was ordered when he started this term up until the 13th of June. So I have to double check the other processes of the apology.
Can I request that we get a formal process as to how many sittings can we be excused out of? Try not to have the tendency of accepting these prolonged apologies, so that if a person is a member of the committee, we ought to see them doing the work of the committee. We are elected as public representatives to ensure that the work of the committee that we are put in is done. And if people have taken leave of absence without proper procedures, we need to scrutinize that further and ensure that they are given notification of their non-attendance. Thank you.
I was going to say something. I was going to say I'll come back with a ruling on the matter. Look, I think the difficult one I remember is the fact that it's, and I take note of Honorable Mandela Reyes, in my view, it should be much more of a awareness thing for the committee itself. When the approach was made, regrettably, a reasonable assumption would have been made that the committee has accepted the apology. I think we'll have to look at that and as to whether, for me, the most critical thing is that whether the committee can accept or reject an apology, that also becomes an item. I think last week also that issue arose, or we just note. Because in my view, the most difficult thing is to move apologies that you cannot reject. In order for you to move, you must also have powers on them. And I'm not sure this is so. We will have to go much deeper than just the issue of the matter of the of how long the apologies. We will have to just look at the matter beyond that. Okay, being the case as it may, we had invited CFIR to make a presentation for today. From there, we will have questions of clarity, and then we will deal with the minutes. You will recall also we had two sets of minutes, which is the, am I correct, 27 and the 30. And from there, we will then have announcements, and then go for adjournment. Is there any mover? Honorable Yambe.
Thanks, Chairperson. Morning, please. Chairperson, I just I adopt the agenda as it is.
Yes, I can. Honorable Mandela.
Thank you, sir. I want to second the move for the adoption of the agenda of the 10th of June 2015 of the Portfolio Committee of Mineral Resources.
Okay, being the case of this May, Prof, we were at your meeting. The last time we met, it was at the Indaba. Okay. Now, we are at your meeting. You can also introduce your team, and then we will take it from there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. It's a real pleasure for us to be with you this morning. My name is Mae Hermanis, and I'm from the CSR, where I'm responsible for the Natural Resources and Environmental Unit. And together with my colleague, Mr. Johan, I'm actually who is responsible for the implementation unit of the CSR, where we have a number of mining-related activities, particularly those concerned with occupational health and safety contemplated. So together we will chat to you today about what we're doing for CSR, but hopefully present you with a perspective on mining R&D and the status of mining R&D and the issues that are of concern. I also would like to indicate to you that we have a member from our Parliamentary Portfolio Office, Mrs. Lisa Felix, in the background, I'm sure you know, and we also have Charles Harding, who is here, in fact, for the transport presentation, and he will be able to start at the room a bit later, but that's what makes up our team. Let me just start at the onset by saying that at the CSR, we occupy a very specific space in mining R&D. And so we are presenting to you a perspective that is informed from that location in the innovation space. And obviously one of the reasons why we are interested in having this discussion is because we see that there are some significant issues that need to be addressed across the space and particularly the areas in which the CSR is active. The second issue that I want to perhaps just raise ahead of going into the discussion, and I think my colleague Jan Leroux will also be talking about some of the issues that we are in the area. But largely, we understand that the mining industry is very complex, and it has legacy issues attached to it. Probably that are much more significant than any other of the sectors in South Africa. So in essence, some of the issues that we will raise are related to those legacy issues. So we're not unaware of them, but I'm obviously focusing on the R&D aspects today, and I'm happy to draw up the linkages as we go along. And I think the message overall is that we're really needing to be looking at those legacy issues in overview, and we're looking at the whole of the mining value chain in order to bring about the kinds of changes that would make the sector successful. And I think the issue that was raised by the Honourable Chairperson right at the beginning about job losses is one of which is sitting in that space where we have a major legacy matter, which unfortunately is linked to significant global changes in the sector, and that have been going on for a very long time. So let me then carry on, and what I want to suggest to you is that I have, as you can see, six areas here to deal with. One is just an overview of the mining sector, and here is really just to tease out how we see R&D related to the mining and mineral sector overall, and then I'll go on to talking about capacity and funding. Some specific questions that were asked of us was about the role of CIMAC, or the Mine Health and Safety Council, in the funding space and R&D space, which has been out there. Then some questions about where to go with mining R&D and the initiatives that we are involved with the CSR specifically, and we'll close with a few conclusions. You're welcome to interrupt me at any time for points of clarity, because I think that some of the issues that come up in the course of the discussion Okay, all right. I think if we start with the South Africa mineral resources as a whole, we know that we have significant mineral reserves, and that's a couple of slides on it. But we have an industry that is mature. It has been, as you are aware, it's been operating. Mining activities have been taking place in a significant way now for over 100 years. So many of the deposits that are easily mined, which are visible on the surface, which are high grade, have already been extracted, or they've largely been extracted. So that begins us then with specific problems about how do we go forward from here, and what kind of new technologies are going to be needed to extract and beneficiate the minerals that remain. So if one starts with the first challenge, and I think this links very directly to the job losses, is that in mining operations, and particularly in gold and platinum, one aspect of our past is that mining is very labor intensive in South Africa. And this is long after changes that happened in the mining sector globally. If one looks at the global trends in the sector, it's towards technology intensity, very small numbers of people working in the extraction process specifically, and also that in certainly in developed countries, a lot more work that's been done in making sure that the technologies that are required by the mining industry are locally manufactured, and that beneficiation happens upstream of the extraction process. So you can see that already what I'm doing is referring to value chain, where we have exploration, which is trying to find out where our reserves are, then looking at the extraction process itself, which is where job losses are, and some of the big global trends that are occurring in that space have an effect, and then looking at the issues of beneficiation. Now, the other challenge that we have, which in a sense reflects on some of the earlier comments, is that our research capacity in a country is both reduced, and it's particularly reduced in the extraction space, the mining space, and it's extremely fragmented. So it's very hard for any institution, even an institution like the CSR, which works across many sectors, to get a perspective on the whole value chain and how it's operating together and whether it's operating coherently. Obviously, the perspective that I'm presenting today is one of concern that it's, we don't necessarily have a coherent R&D strategy for the mining sector. And as you can see, that then goes to the next point. We don't have an overarching minerals value chain strategy, which means that if we look at the mining sector as a whole, where we want to go, and that in itself is being held, that particular question is being addressed by different departments. So for example, in the Department of Science and Technology, there's a particular perspective and a strategy that's been developed around that. Within the DMR, arising out of the MEPIC process is another strategy, which is informed by DMR's place in the minerals value chain. And then there is yet another strategy that is within DTI, which is concerned about the upstream as well as sort of side inputs into the mining value chain. But these strategies have not been brought together into a coherent whole, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And not all of them are in the public domain. And that's a particular issue that we're grappling with in the CSR at the moment. The next issue is that we are dealing with a changing environment and a new set of challenges. So while we have institutions that have been set up, and if I think about them, I think the Council for Geoscience is over 100 years old, MINTEC I think is about 70 years old, CSR is about 70 years old. When those institutions started, there was a particular focus and direction given to mining R&D, and quite frankly, if we look at where mining has come in the last 100 years, the kinds of questions that we need to address now and challenges that we need to address now are very different. And also the challenges that we need to address in South Africa in particular, given our past, given the complexity of the environment that we're in, given the fragmentation that we have in our sector and the tensions in our sector, that we have to recalibrate as we think. And if I talk about a change in focus and scope, some of those go to questions that have become very serious in the current time, which relate to thinking about trade-offs in natural resources and thinking about how one ensures that the endowments of natural resources are endowments that last into the future for future generations. In essence, it means that we need to go back and ask about the mineral system, the whole system. What is it that is required? In our institutions, we've hardened in a very linear way what the value chain looks like. And when I come to that slide, I'll talk to you a little bit about if we see a sort of rethink of a system, what does that mean? And I've mentioned the issue of trade-offs. Now we go to just the minerals endowments. And I think you've probably seen these slides many a time from a number of the institutions that have probably presented to this committee. There is no doubt that we have an abundance of mineral resources. We are the number one in platinum group metals, in chromium, in manganese, in titanium. The map there is just to give an indication of some of the areas where mining is concentrated, and the reserves table that is quoted here comes from the Council for Geoscience, which is a science institution that we collaborate with. And as you can see, South Africa ranks in the top 10 for virtually all of the minerals, bar iron ore, on their table. And that obviously presents us with significant opportunities in the sector. Now, if we look at mining in South Africa, we also know that our economy is generally described as being a minerals energy complex sitting right at the heart of it, meaning that the mining sector has driven the development of the energy sector, and both of those sectors pull in and demand services and products from a range of sectors. So we know that it's a key block sector, and we know that even though its direct contribution to GDP is 7%, it has at the moment and 10%, which is induced through all of those linkages. I think we'd also argue that this mining generates so much of our forex that it probably has an even larger impact on the economy because it enables investments and trade in other sectors. As I started out, I've indicated that mining is very labour intensive, and that means that at the moment the way that our sector operates is at odds with the way in which the sector operates globally. And I think there are a couple of points that also need to be made around this particular point. Is not only do we have many people working in underground situations, which is not the case elsewhere, and if you look at our coal mining sector, which looks far more like what the global coal mining sector looks like, one has a sense of the kind of technology that goes into underground mines globally and the numbers of people needing to operate those mines. What's the issues around labour intensity? It goes to the extent to which one can extract minerals. If one looks at these mines, they are considered to be, they have much greater levels of output that we have for over time and also for the inputs. The other factor is that we see a movement towards open cast mining globally. And so many of mines that have opened up around the world that compete with South African mines, for example, gold's a good one, are open cast. The mega mining that we see in the iron ore sector is an example of big open cast mining. And what this means is that where there is research taking place globally, it's very often around the problems that one encounters in open cost mining. But if we look at South Africa with our platinum reserves and our remaining gold reserves, we need to be understanding how we are going to mine D-level ores. And quite frankly, that's not where research is going globally, and at the moment it's very, very underfunded in South Africa. So that's a significant issue. But we are unable to continue the way that we are, because in the short term it will mean that the expertise that we have in these areas is likely to be depleted. It's very hard to build expertise from scratch, because as you know, it rolls over from one generation to the other to maintain that continuity. And another is that as the GO focuses, as globally there's a focus on open cast mining and the problems attached to it, that the issues around, we can't look outside of the country to help us resolve the issues around D-level mining. We still have more insight and understanding of the challenges in D-level mining than any other country in the world has. So, having said all of that, and I'm basically trying to put the issues around the nature of our gold and platinum industry into perspective, we know in this country that one miner supports 12 to 15 dependents. And that, I think you're very well versed with the figure, that gives us an indication of the enormous social dependence on this industry. We also understand and certainly appreciate in the CSIR that the National Development Plan calls for increasing employment and growth in the country. So, and mining in particular has a critical role to play in the development of the country. The message I'm wanting to get across here is that we are going to have to look at the whole of the minerals value chain acting together for issues of development and job growth. That if there's a focus on one area by itself, we're unlikely to achieve both of those goals together. The difficulty, for example, on continuing to focus on labor-intensive mining is that we're locked into a system which is inevitably being phased out around the globe, and ultimately, even if one looks specifically at the risks in D-level mining, they are not necessarily risks that one would like to see people being exposed to. I'm going to just flag at this point, and a decision that was made in Canada some years ago about making decisions not to have people working in deep-level mines at the rock face in large numbers because it presented huge social risks. Now obviously there they don't have the problem of underinvestment in human resources over 100 years. We understand that these are legal issues. So then to look at the issues of the challenges in the mineral extraction. Now I'm leading here to what are the kinds of problems in the mining sector that are amenable to research and development. Because not all the problems in the sector can be resolved by R&D. And I think you're well aware of the fact that some of them are political issues. Some of them need to be resolved through stakeholder engagement. Some of them need to be resolved in decisions that relate to where the priorities in the country lie in terms of industrial development. So if one considers the role of research and development, we have to ask ourselves what kind of problems in the sector can be resolved by research and by research that is orientated towards developing technologies to applying them and so on. So these are some of the challenges that we think can be resolved by research. The first is that is related to the depth of mining and lower grade of deposits. What this means is that we need to think about the technology that goes into mining at depth. The technologies go to both making sure that the work environment is safe, that the ground is secure, that we are able to, and to think about safety, some of the issues there will not only include the physical environment, the tools that people use, the systems that are used, as well as the ventilation, and risks, for example, of flammable gas explosions, which is covered by our Clarksville facility. Well, it's the lower grey ores. That is something that sits in the beneficiation process inside of the minerals chain, and that's most often areas of work that is undertaken by Mintic. In the CSIR space, we have some work having in the titanium, in looking at the beneficiation of our titanium ores. So those are some of the, that's one kind of problem that we can look at. It's also linked to the others, that if we look at the situation in South Africa, the costs of mining have increased and the risks associated with deep level mining have increased. Now, when one talks about risks, one's not necessarily talking about the outcomes. In other words, the fatalities, the injuries that are associated with those risks. Because essentially, it's the effort and the steps that need to be taken into controlling that risk that results in particular levels of cost and particular outlooks for what the outcomes of managing those risks might be. So we know that in the current environment that our deep level mining is facing both increased risk, which is inherent and needs to be managed, as well as increased costs. If you look at one of the graphs that I put up on the top slide here, that it gives you an indication of this is South Africa's contribution to in the gold sector, and you can see over time our outputs have dropped drastically. One thing that one also needs to consider in relation to the variable to cost is the variability of the commodity prices. In other words, our mines need to be positioned in such a way that they can ride out a commodity cycle. And as you can see at the moment, the way they ride out commodity cycles is by hiring people when the cycle is high and by retrenching people when the cycle is low. So that's the way that system works. As people who carry that cost, we otherwise don't have a way of ensuring that we can ride out the cycles without these huge social impacts. So that's linked to the way that our system is structured. The comparative low productivity in South Africa is a result of our mining methods. The mining methods that we are needing, combined with skill shortages. And the skill shortages obviously relate to the skills that we're needing around artisans, engineers, and so on. Just to give you an indication, and I was speaking to a colleague at Wits University recently about where mining engineers, as you know, who are unemployed in South Africa at the moment, and the younger graduates are struggling to find work, unemployed elsewhere. In Australia and Canada and in the USA, it's not unusual to find a mining engineer operating one of those long wall mining machines. And in South Africa, as you can see, because of the way that our industry structures, that is, our engineers go into largely management and other side, and they're not in the production process per se. So the whole structure of our industry looks very different to what it looks like elsewhere. Then the other issue in the mining sector is a very big one, and one that I'm increasingly familiar with because of the role that I have at the CSR, which is around trades in mining. And one of the consequences of not having an overall strategy is that we're not thinking about the trade-offs and thinking about them strategically as opposed to having to dealing with them operationally. What I mean about dealing with them operationally, it means that when a particular area is earmarked for mining, then the arguments start over whether this is appropriate or not, what the environmental impact should be or not, what the impact on agriculture would be, what the impact on water would be. A strategic view would be to understand and have a perspective on all of our mineral resources and what is mineable at what time and when and whether we can bear the costs of the consequences. So, for example, some of the trade-offs that we are looking at are land use. As we know, mining sterilizes land, and it might sterilize that land forever because it cannot be returned to its original state. But that obviously means that we've made a decision about what we're going to do with the land for a start. The water issues and mining are big ones. Again, in many areas of mining takes a significant investment that had to be made in cleaning up water. And if we look at the way that our system's designed at the moment, we don't see water quality concurrently with mining. So for example, and I'm going to speak off the top of my head now, that if one considered the water quality issues in South Africa, we might have to think about issuing mining licenses along with an obligation to treat water in certain areas of the country. But we don't have the mechanisms for doing that. We don't have a coordinated approach to allow us to see whether that is reasonable to do and if it's appropriate in certain areas. So that, and the other issue about natural resource trails is that mining is a one-off. It's a one-off because once we've extracted our minerals, they are no longer there for the future. So one also not only wants to think about what the trade-offs we're making right now about land use, water, arable land, etc., but also one wants to think about what are future generations of South Africans going to inherit in terms of mineral resources. So there's some very big issues there. In the CSR at the moment, in the natural resource area, we do this kind of thinking for ESCOM, for Transnet. In other words, the institutions that are making big impacts on land. They build infrastructure, some of it goes to sensitive areas, agriculture, water being two issues that one would need to consider. Climate change, what is the big issues that be around big changes in weather, storms, heat waves and so on. So we do that kind of work to support the decision making in the Transnet and ESCOM space. The other issues that we when we think about the challenges and R&D specifically is around our new coal fields. We know that the coal field that we currently extract from is reaching the end of its life. And essentially coal mining has to shift to Moorsburg. That's a very different kind of coal, much harder, contains much more ash, contains a lot of silica, and so it means that in order to mine that coal successfully, one needs to rethink the kinds of machinery that's available, but one also needs to think about the new risks that are attached to it, and the infrastructure that needs to go into that area to ensure that coal field can be opened successfully. Just to indicate what kinds of issues we're dealing with, there's a picture right at the bottom where the black strip indicates the coal that can be mined, and the rest of it indicates all the what we would call gang material that would be waste. And given our technology at the moment, we can't take out just the coal. What we do is we take out that whole sandwich, and then we have to separate the coal out from the rest of the material. So that's a typical technology type challenge. Also, what's happening in this coal field is that this coal has very different explosion and coal dust risks attached to it as to the coal field that we have in the Central Basin. And that Central Basin coal field, as you know, experienced huge disasters in the 1980s when the coal mines mechanized, with very large numbers of workers killed, and 68 workers killed, recall correctly, at Middelbelt. There were of the same order of workers killed at Shabani. There were workers killed in the Middelburg mines, and also we had in the gold area 177 people died in Kinross mine disaster in 1987. Now all of those problems related to how one manages flammable substances underground, how one manages coal dust underground, were resolved through research. And the research facility that is specific to that is the Fox Force facility, which is at the CSR, which at the moment is a facility that's run at a very, very low level. It's at the point where without further investment it will close. The problem that we face is when you open up this new coal field, we're going to face the very sorts of questions that we faced when we worked in the Central Basin, but we won't have the answers, because there's no investment, no R&D investment flowing into that space. Okay, so if we look at the minerals extraction area, I'm focusing on the mining space, and I'll talk, and when we look at mining R&D, I'll connect it all to the mining value chain. So we have here a whole range of problems that need to continue being worked on. One is, how do we mine at depth, and how do we mine at depth given all of the issues that I've already talked about. Those are all the, and of course there are other issues that are arising besides the ones around productivity and resource efficiency, but they relate to the global rules around reducing emissions, reducing waste and tailings. You know, mining has a very big footprint, and it's part of the sterilization of land problem, and we need a lot of R&D to ask ourselves, what do we do with that waste? You know, we can't keep making mountains of waste as we mine. It can be mined differently, so we take up the only the ores that we need and not the entire sandwich. Of course, the safety challenges are ones that will continue as we mine. And again, these are issues that need, the skills in the space need to be built up all the time. We can't ever say that we have the skills, we can stop now, because they need to be passed on, they need to be refined as new conditions emerge, they need to be tailored to new mining conditions, and that's not happening at the moment. And my colleague Johan can talk about the issues that we see in the laboratories that support health and safety in a mining sector, where we have small and a workforce that's very close to retirement. I don't know, Johan, if you want to say a couple of words.
Thank you, May, and Honorable Chair and members. Just very briefly on that, as Prof. May referred to, the Kloppers Bos facility, which is a facility about 40 kilometers outside Pretoria, where it's a DMR facility, it's not owned by the CSR. The CSR is just managing it since 1987, when it was established for DMR. And originally in the 90s, a lot of coal dust and explosion related safety research in place, skills development, as well as then training of miners from the raw coal and gold industry. Now at that stage, significant expertise were available there. However, over the years it changed. For instance, also funding support or baseline funding support from the DMR changed. And since 2005-06, it is quite a challenge to keep it going. So the CSR continued, although it's not its facility, it continued to sustain and support the facility in terms of operational and infrastructure related costs, and to try and retain the necessary skills to at least continue with the safety related training services. So over the past few years, the CSR is in, we trained about 4,000 miners per annum on methane gas and associated training services, also ventilation related training, conveyor belt fires and associated training, and some testing. However, as I say, that this facility is really a challenge to retain it and to manage in a sustainable manner. Because all the challenges that you are well aware of in the mining industry, that also changed. I mean, Anglo is still utilizing the facility quite significantly, but for various reasons, and because obviously the challenges and that they face within the mines themselves, they utilizing the facility to a lesser and lesser extent used to, or resulting from all the other challenges. Like in the past year, we had about 2,500, 2,800 miners that went through the process. Indications are that maybe this year it can even be less. While, as Prof. May indicated, that with the challenges in the mine industry and what is planned in areas like Waterberg and new mines, it should actually be the opposite. We should have actually increased the training and the awareness creation associated with safety matters. However, due to the constraints in the industry, we see the opposite. So we are busy, and I think Prof. May will refer to that. We are busy with a process, mostly with DMR and a whole range of stakeholders, to see what can be done to reposition this. But this is a good concern. So in general, in this whole safety environment, the same applies to air and dust quality testing. The same applies to occupational and human factors research and services and to other testing facilities such as the one in Johannesburg at Cotswold, where the rope testing is done for the mining industry, the mechanical testing and the self-contained self-rescue and back training and research. So the services start with there. We managed to continue with these services, but to really position these in the context of the challenges and the needs as mentioned by me that requires serious attention. Thank you.
Thanks, Johan. I think just to, you know, pick up on a point that Johan made about the training carried out around coal mine safety, particularly around protection against coal dust explosions and underground. One of the challenges in the sector as time goes on is that one always needs to train the new people coming into the sector. And I think that's one of our biggest concerns at the moment is that is the fact that we don't have the same levels of awareness that we had in the 1980s around coal mine explosions when in fact those disasters were happening and they were top of mind for everybody. Now we're expecting people to understand what the power of those explosions are, but they don't have direct experience of that because those disasters took place 20 or 30 years ago. And at the Corpus Christi we have the facilities that also illustrate to people what a coal mine, what the power of a coal mine explosion is. And, you know, if the committee would like to visit the facility and actually see that in action, you're welcome to actually do that. All right, so now I want to talk about the value chain because I think this is where we bring the issues that have been raised together. The mining value chain, in simple terms, looks like it goes from exploration, which is the couple of geosciences seat, through to mining extraction, which is where the CSR is traditionally set, through to beneficiation, which is where MinTech is sitting. So all of these institutions are part of what we call the National System of Innovation that supports research and development along the value chain. And as you can see, that at the moment, these particular institutions are hosted by different government departments. Council for Geoscience and MinTech sits with the DMR. The CSR sits with DSD, the Department of Science and Technology. And DGI has an influence in that it supports industrial development generally. And of course, if you look at the mining sector with all of the side supply chain, upstream, downstream, side stream, there are all sorts of areas where one can innovate in order to improve mining in South Africa or improve mining and mineral extraction in South Africa. So that's the traditional roles. Now, but the minerals value chain is much more than these three areas. And I want to just spell out a little bit here. It's a very busy slide. I'm not going to go through it in great detail, but it just gives you some idea of some of the things that need to be considered, many of which sit in the R&D space along the mining value chain. So, for example, we see in the exploration space, while these licensing and geological mapping happening, the mapping technologies themselves have changed. And I happen to sit on the Council for Geosciences board, and I am aware that that within the Council for Geoscience, we do not have the latest technology, and we do not have the newest laboratories or laboratories that have up-to-date functioning equipment to do the kind of geological mapping that we need. It's under-invested in that space. So mapping technology is something that is required in the R&D space. Then if one looks at the actual process of exploration, it requires people who can drill the new drilling technologies, and certainly in South Africa it's not something that we are leading on. All of the equipment and the technology that feeds into the value chain. And if you go along that bottom, you'll see that in mining development, we would need to be looking at the kind of software that's required to design mines and to simulate how these projects would run. And at least at the moment, There's talk of the digital mining, but the digital mine of the future, and that's really all that goes to, is about being able to beforehand, in using modern technology, look at mine design, understand how the process unfolds, model things that might go wrong or that might work in particular ways. It also goes to looking at different kinds of processes which could be more automated. If you go to the Nordic extraction, we have the issues around the support services for mines. Where's the energy going to come from? Where's the water? What kind of skills do we need? And there are R&D aspects of that as well. I've just mentioned to you the issues of the natural resource trade-offs that need to be made, but one of the other areas in which organisations like CSIR works in, together with other institutions, are issues around how do we generate energy? We don't necessarily need to generate energy off the coal base, which as you know at the moment is very much under stress. Can we have mines working off renewables? And how do we make, can we have cogeneration on mines? And those things all require R&D. Water quantity are big issues. And so the technology around the use of water and ensuring that we have good water quality and that we can feed clean water back into the overall water resources of the country are important. And then if we talk about workers, labour, we need to ask what kind of skills level are required. And a lot of those people who have been successful in the mining industry, and I'm talking about very broadly, not just the private sector, are people who have been grounded in research at the beginning of their careers. For me, it's always interesting when I meet people either in the universities or in other science councils or in the mining sector who run the technology part of their mines, who are responsible for the water, who are responsible for the equipping of mines. Many of them start out in the R&D space because that's where you get a very broad grounding. So that's not happening at the moment. Mineral extraction obviously needs plant equipment, and again, there's a whole issue. Can we work more innovatively? What do we need to do here? Process control and engineering are issues here, though, many of which are all within both of these are and the multi space around concentrating and mining. In the CSIR, we do something like a lot of the process control and around milling and concentrating in the coal mining space, and that's just a traditional division of labor. Smelting and refining sits within the MTEC area. Again, big issues around energy. Very big energy consumer. I mean, I think you're well aware of the pressure that our steel mills, that our smelters are under at the moment, both because of problems in the market, but also because of the availability of energy. Then we go to product design and manufacturing. Again, here in the CSIR, as well as within MINTEC, there is work in the space around what are the products that come out of the mine sector. And also we have the issue of mine closure. And mine closure is no longer simply trying to get the land to be rehabilitated to its original form and to contain pollutants on that land. We're really needing to be thinking about how do we repurpose mine land? Can we turn it back into something useful? Some of the thinking that we've got in the CSIR is can we generate renewables off that land? Can we put renewable installations on that land? Because if you think about mining, a lot of energy infrastructure comes into a mine. Once mining is done, can we reverse that infrastructure by putting renewable energy installations on that land? Can we grow material for biomass, for biorefineries, for biofuels on that land, using the water that's generated there, so that we can essentially make sure that mine land does not continue to be a drain on the economy, because at the moment it is a huge drain on the economy where money has to go into simply maintaining and containing the pollutants and maintaining the overall shape of the landscape. So for us, in the CSIR specifically, we're interested in how do we rethink all the ideas from scratch around mine closure. What I also want to point out about that value chain is that this is the way we traditionally think about mining. Exploration, mine development, primary mining activities, milling and concentration, smelting, product development, and post-mining landscapes.
and they're all of sequential activities. But if we're talking about the kind of challenges that we face at the moment, we've got to ask ourselves, what do we need to do completely differently? So we might have to change the whole way that money value chain works. For example, if one thinks, and I'm going to just use the obvious one, one thinks about where you want to be post-mining, one's actually got to start making sure that you have that post-mining outcome when you're dealing with exploration, when you're dealing with mining development, when you're dealing with the primary mining activities, which generate a lot of waste, because essentially that post-mining landscape is affected by how much waste you produce, how much water, what the water quality is going to be, whether they're going to be water treatment plants, are those water treatment plants needed in the post-mining landscape. So this whole value chain is no longer a valid value chain. And it's not just a South African problem. It's a global problem. I was in an ICMM, International Council for Minerals, meeting last year, a workshop, which was for people like myself who have interacted with the sector over many years, talking about the challenges facing the global mining sector in general. And the message from everybody, and there were many people representing social society, labor, and so on, the message to the mining sector is, you have to rethink the entire process. Your footprint's too big, your impact are too big. The enclaves where you develop, where people are, some small group of people are on the inside, large numbers of people are marginalized, don't work anymore. So there's a rethink that needs to happen, and as I say, we need to be part of that global rethink. Okay, now let's just look at money in South Africa. Mining R&D in South Africa, and I've mentioned the value chain and where the institutions sit, and I'm going to use the exploration, extraction, processing value chain to discuss this. Essentially, here are the key issues in mining R&D capacity. If we look at exploration, going to mining, going to beneficiation, the big R&D gap is in the middle in extraction and mining. So, for example, we have exploration under the care of the Council for Geosciences, but as I mentioned, as a board member, I'm aware of some very significant problems there in relation to the investments in the technology that is available to that funds council, and also an aging and declining number of people working directly into the funds. It's even in that space, even if there's a large number of people working there. In the extraction and mining space, as we have seen CSIR has traditionally worked, we have seen a precipitous decline in capacity, and I'll spend a bit more time on that, and a lot of it is related to the fact there has been no continued investment in that space. Some of the reasons are historical. In the beneficiation area, that's where Mintic sits, and I really can't speak for the challenges facing Mintic, but Mintic certainly has a very healthy balance sheet with quite a lot of investment flowing in. I've mentioned before that we have no overarching mineral sector strategy, so one of the challenges we need is to make sure that the DMR, DTI, and DST strategies come together into some coherent form so we can see all the bits of it in the same place. Because at the moment, the institutions are basically dealing with different aspects of the minerals value chain. We need to see the whole, and if we're needing to innovate across the whole value chain, obviously we need to see it in a coherent way. If one has a coherent mining sector strategy, it's possible then to have a plausible R&D strategy. And we don't, the R&D strategy has to flow from a mineral sector strategy. The mining PAKISA or mining lab that are being planned is something that really offers the opportunity to do this. So, we're all looking forward to being involved in those discussions and helping to understand what the whole of the value chain looks like, and particularly then what are the opportunities for development, for jobs, for protecting what we have, and for ensuring that there is a long-term future. The capacity, if one looks at the mineral extraction space particularly, capacity and funding are interrelated, but they're not interchangeable. So, for example, if you don't have funding for R&D, you cannot do R&D. And that means that the people who work in R&D can no longer be employed in R&D, and they start looking for work elsewhere. And if you look at where our mining capacity has gone, it's gone into areas where governments are investing in building mining capacity. So the Australians and the Canadians have benefited a great deal from the investments we've made in growing people with mining capacity. But funding alone can't jumpstart R&D, and this is really what I think we're particularly concerned about, is that you need to have human capital in the form of experienced researchers with real knowledge of the sector to lead R&D. If one looks at the way research is developed within the CSR or any science institution, if we don't have the specialists here who can kick start R&D, we look for them globally. So, for example, as we move into the nanospace, the nanotechnology area, we don't have the level of expertise we require for R&D here, so we source a very, very innovative specialist from India who's leading the program here and developing our R&D. The big challenge for us is, as I said right at the beginning, research into deep level mining is not a global challenge at the moment. It will become in a couple of generations as all those surface deposits are mined out. But we could find ourselves in a situation where we know our own researchers have long retired and we haven't built another generation of researchers to follow, and we cannot source anybody from outside because there's no one familiar with the types of challenges that we meet. The big problem we've seen in the mining space, the mining sector, is that long-term projects have been replaced by short-term projects. So you have a year-long project, a three-year-long project. Those are not projects that resolve long-term strategic problems, and they're not the kind of projects that secure a career in R&D in the mining area. The funding patterns. Largely, governments drive investment in mining R&D. And I don't necessarily think that that's correct. It's also one of the messages that that people who are involved with the workshop at the ICMM raise, including myself, is that the mining sector globally is an underinvestor in R&D. It's, you know, it invests less than 2%. And if you look at companies who work in the ICT sector, they're investing up to 25% of the revenues in R&D. So they know that R&D is the way they stay ahead of the game. But that's not the case for mining, and that quite frankly is a very traditional feature of the mining sector. But basically what it's meant is that where the private sector has retreated from R&D in South Africa, there is just this gap because the state hasn't stepped in, and it's the private sector that used to fund extraction-related research. And it's the public sector, exploration and beneficiation in South Africa, which is typified by Geoscience and Mintic, that's funded those two areas. Just a bit of facts, if we're looking now at mining R&D, the extraction side, in 1989 we had 800 full-time researchers, of which 660 were at the Chamber of Mines Research Organization. That's where the private sector used to run mining or extraction research. It was then that the overall mining extraction R&D was held by Comro. And over the years we've seen very steady declines in all the major disciplines of mining, and this is in this extraction space. I'm talking about mine ventilation, talking about rock mechanics, talk about rock engineering, talk about equipment design. And Corpus Wood is a good example of some of the risk management systems that we've had in place. And as I've indicated, we've got new issues, new focal points that have come up since then. And we haven't really responded to them because we're stuck in a very old model. If we look at the number of people in full-time mining research jobs at the moment, this is an extraction space, there are less than 50 people, and most of them are at the CSIR. And the CSIR is spread between a number of our units because we've had to ensure that the people who work, say, for example, on mining sensors or technology are placed with other people who work in sensors and technology because their groups are too small. At the same time, we're seeing that the membership of professional societies in South Africa, and you can have a look at them, the National Institute for Rock Engineering, the Mine Ventilation Society, have declined memberships because of the specialists vanishing out of the sector. And at the same time, there is a big demand for training and professional interventions from those professional societies. Now, just look at the funding situation. In the exploration space, which is where Council for Geoscience sits, we have a total of 270 million going into there, with 270 million coming in form of government grants. in the extraction phase, and this is very uncertain because we don't know where all the investments are, it's possibly of the order of around 60 million. And these are all split in full funding of university chairs and funding on specific projects by the private sector. From the government coffers, we have about 25 million flowing out also in small projects from the Mine Health and Safety Council. And from the CSIR itself, which gets a subvention, we have 10 million going into mining. And that 10 million at the moment is what is keeping the researchers who sit in units like the one I'm responsible for going, and they supplement that with some small private project. And in the space where Johan Leroux works, which is where all the laboratories sit, they are supposed to be self-sustaining, and at the moment they are barely self-sustaining, they are barely surviving, because essentially they should be in the space where there is significant demand for the work around self-contained self-rescues, about using copper spools around testing roads and so on, and that's obviously them flowing through. And then in the beneficiation area, we have Mintic with a budget of the order of 487 million, and I just looked at the latest annual report of 2014 that's in the public domain, of which 229 million, not grand million, is in the form of government grants. So you can see we've got a hole in the middle. 209 million. Yeah, and so the M's missing from that. So you can see there's a gap in the middle. There's a huge gap in the middle. And the problem with that gap in the middle is that it's a very significant problem, because one can't translate the good work done by CGS into sensible projects if we don't have the extraction technology. And if we don't have the strict extraction technology, what do we benefit yet? So it's that needs to be addressed. So just to give you some idea again about the extraction mine issues, we used to have collaborative industry funding for productivity and environmental issues. So for example, there were big projects like the projects of Deep Mine, Future Mine, Plat Mine. These were looking at the big sort of strategies for how do we mine deep, what does the future mines look like, how do we mine platinum, and all of that research has stopped. In fact, we haven't even had the opportunity to consolidate all the results of all of that work and put it into the public domain. And that probably is the very first step if we're going to go forward, is what did we learn from the past and can we make use of that. So in the coal sector, the only industry collaborative research funder is Coltec, and they focus on mining productivity and environmental issues. They're not focusing on the issues that are necessarily central to government and government strategy. They will be focusing on the issues that are particular to the current coal mining problems that the private sector has. And that's quite a small fund in the overall scheme of things. So it's about to the order of about 60 million, which is also made up by institutions putting some money in, like the CSIR. Sector-level funding of occupational health and safety is funded traditionally from the Mine Health and Safety Council. It's currently in the order of about 25 million per annum, and it goes out as a sort of small projects. They've in fact reduced the project size to 1-year projects, and they look for small projects. So it's down from 40 million per annum in the past. And the Centre of Excellence, which is expected to have an injection of funds going into, is not yet operating. So everyone who's waiting at the end of that process is very anxious at the moment about that. And I've integrated the CSIR from the DST science and technology allocation to the CSIR, put 10 million into my research, and it's largely focused on trying to maintain our human capital in this space. The industry funding is mainly in extraction phase based on projects to universities, on research chairs, and into some of the collaborative programs around occupational health. But a lot of that work either enters the public domain. When private sector funds research, they often fund research to solve a very particular problem in a particular mine, it doesn't go into the public domain very easily. We also have very tiny centres, the Centre for Mechanised Mining Systems and the Centre for Sustainability in Mining Industry. They're all project funded, and as I'm aware at the moment, all of them are hanging in there by their fingernails. So the Mine Health and Safety Council is predominantly responsible for health and safety research. And I just want to make a pause point here. If one looks at that mining value chain, very clearly the health and safety problems come out of the mining and processing issues. They arise out of the systems that you're in. And if we're talking about system change in the future, we have to link health and safety funding and mining funding. They're not actually separate, but because we've locked ourselves into a particular structure which directs the research into this way, in this way. Also, Mine Health and Safety Council is informed by pot incidents, and that's important because you obviously need to resolve the problems that have led to mine accidents, but you can see what this does. It doesn't direct you to the future. It's about the past, it's not about the future, so it's not about system change. I've indicated that large research problems have stopped, and in terms of the Mine Health and Safety Council Centers of Excellence, it works on using selective services from the CSR and others are referred to as preferred service providers. The operational model for these centres is not finalised, and at the moment we understand there's about 180 million research funds sitting in the council that hasn't been spent. So we do need to go with research now, and I think the points are already clear. We need to be sure that R&D is informed by clear strategy. What's the long-term focus for this sector? How do our local requirements, and both social and environmental, inform the strategy? How do we take account of global developments? How do we build on the capabilities that we've got? And we need to build on the capabilities across the entire spectrum of institutions, especially the country's remaining experts, whether they are in retirement or not. There are too few of them at the moment. Essentially, the watchwords for all of us is we need to coordinate, we need to collaborate, we need complementary efforts. We need to think about how do we get funds into the R&D space, particularly in the extraction space. Some of it can come through sales levies. Some of it can come through the NRF, the National Research Funds, which deals with this, with developing high-level R&D skills. And then, of course, the traditional ways in which money is raised from the sector. One thought is that we could be starting to think about a mining R&D hub again, where we consolidate all the research labs and infrastructure, and they can be virtual, they can also be physical, to rebuild, we need to house and rebuild our mining capabilities. And at the CSIR, while we've had to put the individual groups of researchers that were now in such tiny research groups into their home disciplines, we are doing our level best to coordinate mining research across the CSIR, simply because at the moment there's no critical mass to house for them to be housed separately. And as I've indicated, Mining Pakisa is an opportunity to rebuild, rethink about mining R&D. And at the moment, the discussions around convening a Mining Pakisa coincides with discussions between the institutions, and that includes the CSIR, MINTEC, and the Council for Geoscience and others, all the universities, about developing a mining sector R&D strategy with specific attention to mining and mineral extraction. And this, of course, has been led by the Deputy Minister Olifant at the DMR, who's been particularly active in bringing together all of these institutions and making sure that we actually talk about how we connect all the now very fragmented aspects of the work that we do. The Mining Pakisa, to be successful from an R&D perspective, is going to have to be inclusive of the R&D institutions. Now, I want to just quickly talk about the CSIR, and I'm going to just touch on these things, because I think I've covered some of the key points around it. The CSIR is a multidisciplinary research institution, and our job is to foster research and development that has an impact in the real economy. We need to make an impact on the quality of people's lives, on livelihoods, and we need to make a positive impact in the economy in the form of growth. Now, so we are looking for impacts on the economy and society. We start with inputs of people. If we don't have the people, we can't undertake the quality and the type of research that we want to do. We obviously carry out research, development and innovation activities at the CSIR. We have a number of outputs. Some of them are publications because they need knowledge, but others go into patents and actually technologies that are in, taken into the sector itself. So we work on material science, photonics, robotics, modeling, ICT and so on. And you can see that these are all technologies that combined can fit into the mining sector. If you look at the area that the CSIR's researchers are arranged around, we have industry, including mining industry, health, energy, defense and security, natural environment and built environment. They don't sit in silos necessarily. A lot of our work will be across those departments because the type of work that we require to do, the type of outputs that we require, draw on a range of expertise. We have the demographics of the CSIR is that we have 2,411 people on the staff, of which 1,691 are people who are science and engineering technologists. We have 310 doctorates. Now, if you look globally, our level of doctorates could be higher, and that's an indication of the extent to which in South Africa we're able to promote science and R&D as a research, as a career, but also as a result of the investments that we're seeing in the area. We need to invest in so we can grow the number of PhDs. Many research institutions globally have very much higher levels of doctorates on the staff. If we look at whom the CSIR works with, we work with state-owned enterprises, development agencies, government departments, tertiary institutions, private research agencies, and industry. Sometimes those are partnerships, sometimes they are clients, and sometimes there are people, there are institutions that are providing some inputs into the CSIR's agenda. We very specifically are looking at how we take our takeaways are with the NDP, as well as the other documents that have been produced that speak to the development in the country. And if we look at where we sit relative to other institutions, right at the bottom of the slide, you will see that the tertiary institutions, like the universities, are strongly positioned to generate new knowledge. In the CSIR, we generate some new knowledge, but we are largely sitting where we're looking at applied research and technology, and then we look at how we transfer that into industry, and we taper off there. The uptake then comes from industry and the public sector in taking up the technologies that are developed in the CSIR. If you look at mining, we know now, if we look at the top graph, that mining R&D has advanced to the point where in South Africa we had a stable system, but we are now starting to go down the curve, and we're needing to think about how do we get another upswing where we're talking about a new future. So how does the South African mining industry make the change from stepwise progression out to a revolutionary change that we require, given the massive challenges facing the sector? So we need to go from evolution to revolution. Now, the big issues around R&D here, it needs to combine government strategy, where the private sector is going, what the public corporations, ESCOM, Transnet, are doing, and all of that needs to inform R&D. So the tensions in the mining industry are very difficult for those of us who work in the R&D space, because we're not getting a coherent perspective and a coherent mandate about where it is we need to take R&D, because it depends on all of those. Policy, where our public corporations are going in terms of their capacity and the infrastructure, and what's happening in the private sector, and what are the challenges, and how do we bring that all together into something coherent. So if we look at where we are now, we're committed to contributing to the interdisciplinary challenges in the sector. We believe we must be working with the other institutions, and we should be maximizing all the impact areas in the CSIR. So if we look at the mining, at the future mining, in the CSIR we have a mining research impact area, which is currently under discussion and being coalesced, and we're looking at efficient, safe, competitive production, with improved efficiency, reducing exposure to hazards, understanding natural resource trade-offs, and also adding to the post-mining minerals processing, post-mining landscape, as well as some of the minerals processing aspects. It goes back to us understanding that we need to influence the entire value chain for both jobs and development in the country. So far, we've mapped all the competencies across the CSIR that are relevant to mining, because they're more than simply the people that used to sit in the mining space in the past. We've looked at the business plan for Cross Gulf, which we have presented to the DMR, and we're hoping that will take off. We are coordinating a workshop at the moment with which involve other institutions and other government departments, including the DMR, and that's the initiative that's being led by the Deputy Minister. And this is really to try and see if we can't already start understanding what is in the different mining strategies and how do they come together. In the CSIR, we're talking to the Department of Science and Technology about managing the Rock Innovation Program. This is a small program. The order of funding is just a few million, but it's about thinking about where do we go in terms of our deep level mines in the innovation that we're needing to adopt and to develop in the mining sector. At the moment, one of our colleagues who would have been with us today is in fact looking at an international collaborative program, in this case in Finland, but we are looking at how do we collaborate with other countries that have mining problems that are similar to ours in some respect, so that we can continue to build and ensure that we have the capabilities to conduct the necessary research in South Africa. We're also engaging in China with Bigram, and they're very interested in the sensor technology that the CSIR has to understand the mining environment. The mining champions are Navin, who's not here today, who's gone off to Finland, who's the mining RIA champion, Johan Leroux, who's responsible for the implementation unit, and as he's indicated, the key laboratories that are so important for mine health and safety, of course, the road testing laboratory, the air and dust testing laboratory, the human factors people, as well as the self-contained self-rescuers, and these are the instruments, I'm sure you've seen them, miners, the packs that miners carry on their belts, that are necessary if there is a problem underground, that help people get to the self-contained, to the rescue base. And then of course myself, and I'm responsible for champion mining, and that's the capacity out here today. So that's the long, long story, and I hope that it's been helpful to you, and thank you very much for the opportunity to present this.
Okay, thanks Prof. Not always power shed, so let me use the unfamiliar phrase. With the powers vested in me, I'm giving you 5 minutes stretch break, just 5 minutes. Thanks, Prof. and your team. Yeah, it's a marathon. You try to level best, and this is on time. Can we take us 5 minutes stretch break and then come back? If you come back after 5 minutes, we'll have forgotten what you wanted to ask. So the sooner you come back, everything will be collected. Thank you.
The one in my office, not come in the
but I was ready for the information from this discussion here.
No, there are no ideas, not what the forms of the theology.
Oh, okay.
I was going
to
speak to the men.
For the first time, I'm going to spoke to how you are engaged to the
community.
I was having the colorful energy from you and I went to this corner, which is about something.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can the boss come to the back? Thank you, Honorable Member. I know you also took some of our time. I'm not trying to give any because they call it optional time. I know we finally have to arrive at the conclusion of what do we think should constitute the way forward. But for now, can we, like we did, Prof, you bear with us in committee. We listen, we take notes, equally that's your turn to listen, take notes, and then respond. Finally, we will deal with the what that should constitute the way forward. Can we will deal with that. Where I used to be, when somebody says a concern, we used to say concern is noted for us. Can we get questions of clarity and comments, and probably this time around an additional bonus, an additional bonus. Suggestions. So you are allowed to make suggestions. Honorable Lorima, Honorable Beginning, Honorable Nambi, Honorable Jaska, Honorable Mandela. Okay.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I've got a lot of questions, so I think because of that, I'm going to just ask you, ask them in two tranches, and just warning them not in any particularly logical order. It's just as they occurred to me as you spoke. First of all, can you, and there were about half a dozen in the first round, could you comment on the effectiveness, the comparative effectiveness of private versus state funding for R&D? Secondly, this is a huge question. What's the future of labour-intensive mining in South Africa? As you know, it has huge implications for not only those people involved currently in mining, but also the potential for employing other people, of whom we have nearly 8 million needing jobs. Third question is about safety practices. How do our safety practices compare to those in other mining jurisdictions? And then as regards overarching R&D strategies, can you give us an example of a jurisdiction which has a government-organized overarching R&D strategy? What's the, give us a comment on the utility of this. Why is that a good idea? Is it a good idea? Who else is significant already in deep level mining at the moment? You talked about Kloofbos being a DMR facility. Who should be funding the work that's being done there? You seem to indicate there was some sort of public-private partnerships happening there. Could you tell us more about that? And if you tell us what the DMR budget line is, what part of the DMR does that come from? I think I'll stop there, though.
Thank you very much,
Chair. Both speak about the aging of laboratories. And I think during our visit to your site in Linton, we did find out that all laboratories are aging. Now, a process that can take 2 days or a day, it takes weeks to come to the regular result. And therefore, it really becomes a necessity that if a state can really invest on equipment, it could assist on the process of penetration, localization and penetration. That's my view as well. The other matter that we observe through research and development, I think any country, in order to progress or going forward to its future, so it could develop economical growth, they can't do that without having a strong research and development capacity. Now, our downfall in South Africa, my view, we allow geoscience and others being used and being taken outside the country. And therefore has to be examined that is able to stand on its own to say in terms of resources. Because 10 years ago there was some work done by geoscience in that area. And then they find some kind of resource underneath the source. And therefore those blocks are starting now. That's why when you look to their regions, they are 7.1 now. In terms of the HTTP. So I'm talking about that. Therefore, it means in South Africa, if we can start with invest more on R&D and the issue of mapping of our country to see where, what kind of a resource in one province to another. And therefore, we start that process. So that when we are able to say, we start to dig at a particular time, or the investment people to invest will come over because they will know what is there in the Eastern Cape, what is there in Western Cape, what is there in a particular area. I think these are the areas. I don't want to sound as issue for asking questions, but what I want us to do together, how I will make sure we turn things around together in going forward. And again, on your own growth, trying to assist us to say what kind of investment that you think that state, the role that can play by the state in changing things around in order to save our country. I'm saying to save our country in terms of thinking, because we can't have engineers that are underutilized. We are very clear, I know that you will take somebody, it's more of doing as an engineer, but is appointed to do something else, not focusing to where and where its key is. I think that's the problem. So we have people that are really underutilized. And therefore, and again, kind of a program that is supposed to have to deal with scarce skills. What kind of a plan that can deal with scarce skills? But I think you can have a pool of it and able to identify them. And therefore, when we equip our youth in general, we are able to say our students, this is the way to go. Presently, we are talking about science and math all the time, but I think it should be more than that, because on any country, because if you go to Canada or other areas, you will find out there is on land and rural, but now they are able to do things on automotive sector. For instance, Thailand at this stage, Thailand is rich on land and rural and land. But today they're able to produce cars on their own. And therefore, they're able to have beneficiary on the north end, over there. So these are the issues which I said I was saying. I think I wanted to focus on the issue of aging my children, which we need to be able to invest more. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman. Although some of the questions would be irritation, as honorable, Prof has mentioned the issue of shortage of skills and also the aging offices, officials in the department. I want to know whether they have any problem of intent as well as others in order to equip the incoming generation in their sector. Also, I want to know what is the average age of the officials that they need within their organization. And also, looking on page 11, I just want to know, is there any strategies that they have in order to communicate this information? Because when you look down there, it includes a number of departments, not only the mineral resources. Thank you, Chair.
that's two questions, because mostly some have been asked, maybe that is an advantage or if not a disadvantage of talking after that. In one of our visits, in our oversight visits, we were made to believe that in South Africa, the demand for exploration is increasing. So, given the constraints or that have been cited in this or mentioned in this presentation, I just want to know how do you see the future of a mining industry in this country where we will be lacking with the researchers and so forth, lacking skills and all those. Also, I wanted to also emphasize on the question that Honorable Biginini has mentioned or has asked, the intervention maybe of the state, how do you see or where do you see the intervention of the state, where do you see that the intervention of the state is mostly required to save the situation in the mining industry. I think some chair have been asked. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Let me first and foremost welcome the presentation made by Professor May Rwanda. CSIR. Chair, if I may, just gain clarity, particularly what my colleagues, the honorable members, have been talking to in the challenges of building capacity and training. The province alluded that we are scoring very low in terms of our own researchers are not as qualified to our counterparts externally in the African continent as well as in the global community where our counterparts are holding PhDs as well. We are just coming in with the just necessary qualifications. What can we do to ensure that we are as competitive? I sometimes, even within the parliamentary forums, as we move along in Africa, just in the Southern region and the African continent, our counterparts as parliamentarians are holding masters and doctorates, and it tends to be quite a challenging situation when you find them speaking very eloquent on the subject and the topic because they are highly qualified and learned. So just want to know what are your thoughts in terms of ensuring that we as a country can produce highly skilled individuals that can compete at that level and engage at that level. Secondly, Chairperson, if we may move to slide 14, which talks to that there's approximately 800 full-time employees which were at its peak in 1989. But we have gone down to as less than 50 people in full-time mining research. I would like to understand what has led to the drastic decline in the full-time researchers. You can give us an understanding as to what are the contributing factors to that drastic decline. What can we do as a state and government to ensure that through the department we are able to grow that and have a number of full-time researchers employed and capacitated? Thirdly, Chairperson, on slide number 17, if I'm correct, we'll talk about the need to prevent further losses. How do we prevent further losses, particularly when the NDP calls for an increasing employment and growth in South Africa? But what is more alarming, Chairperson, is the bottom bullet point, which says out of the annual reports there's an excess of 180 million rand for research funds which remains unspent. How can this be prevented, and how do we ensure such funds are utilized? And what would the professor suggest that should be the punitive measures that would be undertaken to ensure that funds don't sit neglected and not utilized for the cause that they were allocated for? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The presentations from the CSIR. Chair, mine are the following. What is my other slide? You interrupted me. Thank you. One, Chair, relates to the Mine Health Safety Council Centers of Excellence not operating yet. There's a budget of 25 million per annum, which I think in my own view must be utilized for the services of some of these centers. I just want to know what are the reasons for this MSC not operating. The other one relates to the day-to-day. Do you have a strategic plan in place to address the challenges mentioned before with regard to mineral extractions? Do we have that in place? The other one, Chair, my colleagues have made mention of, but the other one is that the report we got is that 400 miners were trained, and I didn't get the news that where are these miners, where are they placed? Because you're just playing them, sitting at home doing nothing. Where have you placed these miners? Well, yeah, that's it for now. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair. And I'm going to, I think, between myself and my colleagues, we'll try and address the questions. We'll try to address them briefly so that we don't have a long period of talking again. In terms of private versus state funding, you know, the question of effectiveness is probably a misnomer in the sense that if one looks at state funding is usually projected towards the future. So, you know, if one looks at the state, it takes a strategic view of the sector and it looks at what is required in the future and what needs to be addressed that is particularly untenable, that's falling between the gap of the present. So I think they have different goals. Private sector funding is very often focused on what immediate problems need to be resolved, whether they're processing problems, whether they're problems with machinery that keeps breaking down, and it's, you know, it's a very common problem, for example, when we imported, when we started mechanizing coal mines, the machinery that was imported here just simply didn't function under our conditions, so there was a lot of R&D around trying to sort that out. And by the way, that was one of the reasons why all those terrible disasters happened. So they have different roles. And you can see, if I go back to the mining equipment coming to the coal mines, that the state's response to that was to get up corpus force.
I'm not sure whether this thing was waiting for us to ask questions.
speak louder.
You may try and come closer, but I'm not sure that is there any intervention that can be made there, or we will try and bear with it. But it's an unbearable noise. So I'm just saying you will have to compete with the, in the meantime, you'll have to compete with what we don't know what is it.
Okay, so, gee, I think the point then is in terms of the funding of research, there are different interests for the state and for the private sector, and hopefully their different efforts should be complementary. In terms of labor-intensive mining's future, I think we have a real problem here, honourable members, because if one looks at what is happening in the country, is that South African mines are slowly becoming mechanised, or they're being closed where we don't have mechanisation options, and it's happening by default because the global trend, as I say, is open cast mining and very in technology intensive mining. And what we face is that if we don't have a perspective on how we would like our industry to operate and how we maximize the whole of the minerals value chain, by default we will simply find ourselves marginalized in the areas where we are extremely labor intensive. So that's my personal view. I don't know, Johan, if you have a perspective on that. In terms of safety practices, I think that the safety practices in South Africa are comparable to those elsewhere. But I started off by saying if you look at the type of mining we do, we have many, 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 many workers underground, and our mines look very different to the overcast mines that you would see in many countries around the world. So what you require in a deep level mine is very different to what you require in an open cast mine. So some of the things that we need to do are unique to our situation, so we need to create the solutions for them. The other places where there are some deep mines are Poland, India, the big coal mines, China, but you know, those are not necessarily places that we would want to compare ourselves to. So I'm going to just leave that there. In terms of an overarching R&D strategy, here's an example. A letter from CASA on something called MICA, which is the Mining Innovation Commercialization Gap, which means that they want to innovate in mining and they want to make sure that whatever they innovate in becomes commercialized and becomes technology that's not only available in Canada but all around the world. So the Centre for Excellence in Mining Innovation has now announced that the proposed the Centre program has been approved. So the national government in Canada has decided that they need a program. They've asked the various states and universities to compete for what that program should look like, and that is how they are looking at the future of mining. So that goes to how the state role is mining going in the future? How do we make sure that that the state supports the future or secures the future of the sector? One can look this up on the internet. It's called the CMI, the Centre for Excellence in Mining Innovation Canada, and you see what they're doing there. Now, just as a matter of interest, that is also the place where deep level mining R&D is being done, because Canada sees that in the long run, mining will get deeper, because sooner or later you're going to run out of all these surface ores, and so they're building for the long run. They do have some underground mines in Canada, and in fact, the few researchers that we have left in South Africa are ones which the Canadians are often communicating with. We still have a couple of people who are either quite close to retirement, but who have the kind of skills that people are very, very interested in globally. So that answers that question. Talk about what we should fund. Again, it goes back to the question that I raised earlier. The mining sector should make sure that, I think I'm going to ask you, I'm going to speak to some of this, is that the training that is required by mine workers in order to understand the kind of hazards you're dealing with in coal mines, and they are extremely serious or well understood, and that's what's happening at Corpus Christi. It should fund that. It should fund everything that supports that, including anything that is related to changes in technology in the industry that relates to changes in how that training is done. And that also includes training for the engineers and mine managers who run those mines, because unless they have had direct experience of a coal dust flammable gas explosion, they will not understand what they require. And that's why that facility is so important. So the operational issues in mining should ideally be funded by the mining sector. But if you ask for the state needs to be asking the questions around what is Corpus Christi's role in the Waterberg issue about the open.
Thank you, May. I think she covered one component of your help with Corpus Christi, and maybe also to just address a question that came later. The reference to the 4,000 miners that get trained and leaky 2,500 last year. These people are from the mines, so it's the miners from Anglo, Sasol, etc. that get sent there for this awareness training that we just referred to in the concerning explosions, etc. So those people go immediately back into those mines as workers. But workers who are much better aware of the safety issues and the importance of certain ways of operating underground in terms of safety and explosions, etc. So I agree with May that from a funding point of view, I think for those training services and associated testing that the private sector, the mines, should cover those costs as they currently do. However, for a facility like that of the EMR to get it back to where it were in the 1990s, a significant investment is required in terms of infrastructure, as the Honourable Member also mentioned earlier, that the case in a number of facilities in mining in South Africa. We are busy finalizing the business plan through the process that May refer to with Dean Willifant and a whole network of national stakeholders. Is to be exactly at that to propose business plan, because what we need to do is to bring an additional capacity to what is there currently to actually develop the appropriate services that is active. And that will be done then jointly with your universities and other such councils, etc. So basically, to answer the question, the existing services to sustain the training that's there, private sector should fund that. Government, DMR, etc., Mine Health Safety Council should come in to, and we did submit some proposals to re-establish some of the infrastructure and to bring in the necessary capacity to develop the additional services that is required for Crop's possibility to function for what it was built for in 1982 and 1987.
So that takes us to the next set of questions, which was through Honourable Kennedy. I think the first issue was about just a general comment about ageing infrastructure in our institutions, and quite frankly that is a significant matter. And as I think colleagues have indicated from MINTEC, what the problems we face is that if we cannot conduct the research here, it will be conducted elsewhere. The companies that operate, whether they're in mining, whether they're in pharmaceuticals, whether they are in food, will take the research questions elsewhere. And so I think that that if we are going to stay at the forefront of R&D, we need the fundamentals are that we need to make sure that our infrastructure, R&D infrastructure, is properly maintained at the cutting edge. And I think too the question that was raised earlier about the role of state and private sector funding is also the question of how we see South Africa as Team South Africa. And I think that probably goes to some of the concerns that certainly some people like ourselves have about the mining sector. If we had a Team South Africa approach, it might mean that the companies can contribute more. It might be that, you know, beyond the mining sector as well, that there are companies who are prepared to see as part of their responsibility contributing to the building of R&D. And perhaps that's something that one needs to have in part of our national conversations about really going. if one looks at R&D particularly and the fact that other countries might take advantage of R&D from South Africa, you know, the issue about research and development is that it's global. And for people to operate in the R&D sector, they have to publish their research. It needs to be verified by others elsewhere, and that's the way science progresses. So it's a global business. The way that countries stay ahead in terms of R&D is they patent the technologies that come out. Our system provides for patents, but it's not necessarily sitting in the DMR, and that's why our system is quite fragmented, and at the moment we need to bring it together. What is it that we need patents in the space? How do we protect the technology that we develop? Those are other kind of questions around intellectual property and patents that, as I say, we certainly have provision for. And then more than that, we need a first mover. We need to be able to move on what we've done, because, as you know, it's the first movers who change the paradigm, and as long as we've as long as we're not able to take advantage of our own technologies, others will. So there's no guarantees in the R&D space that one can hold what we have close to our chests. And in fact, as you know, as people move around the globe, and I see how global R&D is, particularly from the vantage point of the CSIR, is that this is in people's heads. People carry the expertise with them. So we need to make sure that we develop a project, people that are committed and have reasons to stay in the R&D sector in South Africa. I'm going to go on to the issues around the kind of institutions and the strategy, the kind of investment that governments need to make. I think the first investment that we need in the mining space is an investment in developing an overall, overarching strategy for the mineral sector. Only government can lead that. Only government can indicate that it needs to be done, and only government can bring together all of the parties to contribute to ensuring that we have a plan. And we have an understanding of the complexities in our sector at the moment and a plan to go forward. So I think that is the very, very first step. And then, of course, the investments that are required are the kind of investments that are leaving our organisations sitting at the moment, which is our ageing R&D infrastructure. That's a quick fix that would keep young researchers and institutions. Now, we talked about engineers who are underutilised. There are two difficulties here. If we don't have problems that we are working on, there is no work for people in the R&D space as there is in any other space. And at the moment, in the mining extraction space, there's no funding. We basically mean there are no big programs of work. There are no big problems that are being put before researchers to resolve. And so that, I think, is part linked to understanding where we're needing to go. So that's the way we would draw engineers into the space. How do we equip young people? I think in the CSIR, we've really thought quite a lot about how do we grow human capital in this R&D space, which you need to grow at a very high level. And at the moment, you know, our thoughts are that the systems that we've got, we're needing to even tweak more. Because if you look at where young researchers are in other countries by the time they're 30, they usually have their PhD. They'll have their PhDs at 25, 26, 27, 28. That's the sort of due time. Our researchers achieve their PhDs very late, and often that means that they're having to try and find ways of being employed as well as trying to grow in terms of their career. In many of these R&D careers, you only start when you've got your PhD. Some engineers, if they're very experienced and they've got a lot of industry expertise, can go a long way without their PhD. But in the science spaces that I'm responsible for, you start off, their PhD is a starter for a science career. It's not an input. So we've got to look at how we fast-track people. How do we make it possible to fast-track that people can concentrate on getting their PhD early on, and maybe we need to rethink how we identify the people who we can take on that fast-track. That's just a thought about that, but there's no easy answer to this, because, as you know, part of what we're talking about is the huge underinvestment in people coming from our past.
I can maybe just say that there are, through the NRF and other programs, there are internship programs, not necessarily dedicated to mining, but then in institutions like the CSR and some of the other science councils and the universities, they then capitalize or utilize those programs to also address human capital development through internships in mining. For instance, in the CSR, we have quite a few interns with a mining focus through those programs that we refer to. I also just wanted to come back to the question earlier about examples of national strategies, etc. And I think that, yes, obviously Canada and others can be used. They are very good international examples. But I think we should also not ignore what South Africa did, in not necessarily in mining, but in other sectors. And I can think of two, for instance. And the one is in 2005-06, as a support to the National R&D Strategy, the Advanced Manufacturing Technology Strategy for South Africa was developed through a collaboration between industry, government, and the academic and tertiary environment and science environment. And that resulted in a multi-year implementation plan of Advanced Manufacturing Technology Strategy for South Africa. The CSR was key in driving the implementation of that through these other partners, or with these other partners. And many of the initiatives today, like the nanotechnology centers in South Africa, that is really, I think, of a high standard. The whole program about titanium beneficiation, the program about micromanufacturing, electronics and automation, all of that resulted, and the composites program in South Africa, with a strong focus on application in aerospace and building industry. That all resulted from that National Advanced Manufacturing Technology Strategy. So basically what I want to say is I think in South Africa we know how to go about it, getting it done, to develop such a plan. Just recently it was also the development of the aerospace sector development plan. And now the different programs like the ETI, the DST, etc., etc., that National Aerospace Plan directs the funding and the programs of these different departments. So basically I'm just saying that I think we have learning in South Africa how to do these things. I think it's getting together and get it done.
Thank you, Hans. Just in terms of thinking about the age of researchers and what's the ideal age, essentially what we have at the moment is, if you like, a bipolar situation. We have a few very senior people who are literally within 2 years of retirement. They're either in their late 50s or their early 60s. And we have a cohort of very young people who are either fresh out of university or within 5 years of being out of university. And that is a problem because we don't have the middle ranks of people. So ideally what one would want to see is that you have a pipeline that essentially tapers towards the top and not this bipolar situation that we've got now. So some of our thinking going forward, if we do get to a point where we can develop a roadmap for mining R&D coming out of the strategy, is that we would have to ask ourselves what we need to do to make sure that we get the kind of spread of expertise that we have. Obviously the big danger for us is if the senior people retire, what happens to the juniors? And that I think is something that for all of us who are running units in the CSR, it gives us rabies at the moment, but we absolutely have to find a way to do that, and we might have to do that by bringing in individuals who are post-retirement to play some role in that sense. Just going on to the questions around exploration and the future of the mining industry. I think the big issues for the mining sector is to understand where the mineral potential is, but to also be careful about how that mineral potential is realized over time, because we really need to think about the generations for the future here. And I think for me, I see that the mining sector is going to go, and I'm now not talking about South Africa necessarily or the South African private sector necessary, but I think mining is going to undergo very serious questioning about where mining can take place. A lot of not in my backyard is happening, and it's happening for very good reasons, because people see that their water is affected, that they, that if you, you know, if you mine, you have to lower the water tables, so you have to protect the workings. You have to keep the workings dry. So below the water tables means that if you have people who are involved with agriculture, particularly people who are subsisting on land, you can't do that next to a mine. The water tables lower it. So these are some of the things that the mining sector is going to have to deal with. It means that the questions around, can you keyhole mine, can you go in there and just take up what you need? Can you mine in such a way that you can biodigest underground so that you don't create this big footprint? So there's big, big, big issues for mining. It's all going to be changed. Just as a matter of interest, if the mining costs increase, and they are increasing because of all the, not only the difficulty of mining, but also all the externalities attached to mining, the cost of the cleanups and so on, that you're probably going to see recycling become a big thing, recycling of metals and minerals. We don't know how to do that properly because we have what we call horrible, I've forgotten the term, but essentially what it means is we've created materials that you can't separate into their separate parts. And at the moment, there are already people thinking about how do you manufacture, so that when you're finished, you can separate the material into its constituent parts and reuse it. So I think the mining sector is having to both think about how does it work and then how it's sitting in a value chain where recycling is going to become increasingly attractive. Interventions of the state, again, I think it goes back to that. We need a roadmap here. We need a strategy. We need to put our aging infrastructure to rights. And we're also needing to look at the hard issues that are facing us, the issues that mining is no longer a labor-intensive activity around the globe. Top mining countries don't mine in this way. The mining industry has huge externalities. What kind of interventions from R&D do we need to actually reduce them? So those are some of the questions that we have to face as hard as they are. In terms of Honourable Mandela's questions, they were around building capacity and training PhDs, and I think I've already answered that about trying to fast track people. And I do think that, again, what we're dealing with is partly a legacy issue in South Africa, in that we haven't, you know, people just haven't had the opportunities or the room to continue with the education. And I think we see that playing out. I mean, you've probably seen articles in the press from the United States, for example, where Americans who are not wealthy don't have the opportunity to study because it's all privately funded in there. And essentially what they have is a system now where only people from families and backgrounds who have the resources to continue their studies will do so, and increasingly the society becomes polarized because access to higher education is very increasingly unequal. I think that's happening around the globe. And if we put that on top of our legacy, as you know, we have a recent people disaster, so we really need to think about how we create more opportunities and allow people to come through their education to the point where they are in the R&D space, recognized globally as people who are working in that area. I go to the slide 14 that was referred to about the 880 people working in 1989. That was the time when the mining sector funded extraction work in the country. So the COMRO was in fact an organization of the Chamber of Mines. The Chamber of Mines was a research organization. It was funded by mining companies, and it was funded by mining companies to try and overcome the issues largely in deep level mining. So the ventilation issues were dealt with there. Some of the rock mechanics, seismic research was all around that space. How do you cool those mines? Big refrigeration and ventilation. Work came out of there. The shaft sinking, deep shaft in South Africa, which still has that
kind of expertise was all therapy. When they stopped, I mean, it got to a point where I think, you know, that other, that it simply became clear to the chamber that they could see, they could firstly allow what had been done, allow the minds to operate many years into the future, so they could take their foot off the brakes, they weren't necessarily looking at where they're going into the future, and increasingly other research institutions around the globe opened up with government funding. So we, I mean, our research into the extractive space basically came to a halt started declining when the private sector stepped out of that space. I'm not sure whether we can go back there given global trends at the moment. What do we do as a state? I think the same answers go. We need an overall strategy, we need a roadmap, we need to know the roles of different constituents, and we need to essentially be on the same page in South Africa. How do we prevent further losses of researchers? I think that's critical because researchers will stay where they can do meaningful work. They need to begin to have meaningful problems to work on. They need to have equipment that operates and they need to see that they're making an impact. So they won't stay in a vacuum. I mean, sometimes people think it's possible just to put people in a laboratory with the fanciest of equipment, but if there isn't anything substantive attached to that, we won't retain our researchers. They will go to where they can work on substantive needs problems, and often that's the reason why they come into research. So all of the teams are around us getting together a coherent plan. The Minor Conservancy Council, now that's a thorny one. you know, and I am concerned about perhaps commenting on something that perhaps the DMR could better explain. But my understanding of what happened in the council was that there was some discontent on what that on about the work that had been done and hadn't been applied in sector, and that was one of the reasons why funding stopped while there was an attempt to try and get the sector to adopt new technologies and so on. But for a long time we haven't had, again, a sense of what the major mine health and safety problems are and what we need to invest. The Centres of Excellence represent thinking in that direction because they are built around what are considered to be the major issues in mind. That is statements are long to get underway, I think, is a significant problem. I think talk of the centre started about 6 or 7 years ago, so it's taken a long, long time for the council to get to the point where the centres were launched, and they were launched at the last summit. And there was an intention to have them operating by March this year, and we're now in June, so there's still obviously problems there. I think, again, this is part of the problem where we don't seem to be able to articulate what the major priorities are in the mining sector and to put the funding behind it. And the piecemeal funding doesn't help anybody because it doesn't give substance to a long-range problem that people can work on over time. I think the unseen money in the council is a cause of concern. It's a cause of serious concern because it also speaks to a disconnect between the decision makers in the funding space and the people who actually conduct research. I think we've made the point that without continued opportunity work to work, we can't keep the R&D, the researchers in place, and also we can't develop our young researchers because there's nothing for them to do. So that gap where the older people stay on because they're not necessarily needing to build their careers, the middle people move on because they're still very actively building their careers, and we have people in the pipeline who can't get the necessary experience, and I think that's a sort of consideration that people who fund research need to bear in mind, that if they simply take the funding away, we are unable to continue building our research into non-producing research.
And I think that covers all of the questions that were asked. I don't know if I missed any, Johanna, if you'd like to add.
No, I don't think missed, just maybe for further clarity, I have one of my national safety council, I just wanted to add, and maybe you can also correct me, but the slides referred to the 25 million and that honourable member referred to. My understanding is that is the 25 million rand that Minor Health and Safety Council invested over the past number of years per annum in various projects. So that's the 25 million rand. And that may be CSIR, universities, other science councils got involved in that research projects for 25 million rand, adding up to 25 million rand per annum. However, the Minor Health and Safety Council Center of Excellence, this initiative that they now launched recently, that is where the 150 million rand sits. And they did run a process, a call for proposals, and they received these proposed proposals towards the end of last calendar year, December, January, and they are in review process of these proposals to make decisions on what will be invested in and what not. So I just wanted to clarify the separation of the 180 reference to the 25 million per annum reference.
I think I just want to make the point, so that the Minor Health Safety research spending is really a drop in the ocean when you look at the full range of research that needs to be done. So even if that 40 million or 180 million were available as an injection and then ongoing research, it wouldn't solve the R&D related needs in the sector.
Okay. I don't understand, like I'm locking you out like Donor of the Barrel. Let me give you the price of that.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Some of my questions have been already. Can I start from a comment on, I know that AngloGold has got some very interesting technology for drilling out reefs rather than blasting them out. Is that the future of the coal mining industry, you think? So I'd be interested in your opinion on that. Waterberg? Who are the big players there, and are we likely to see more underground mining in the Waterberg, or is that all going to be open cost? What would be the payoff if there were increased funding to the CSIR for mining related research? What is the take up by the mining industry of research that is currently underway? Your titanium projects, why did the CSIR end up doing that and not Mintec? Finally, the need for a roadmap, who should draw that up? And is that something that you hope is going to emerge from Pakisa?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'll be quick. The AGA approach to looking at essentially what is construction technology and applying that to mining is part of the future of mining. It's about thinking completely out of the box, changing the paradigm completely. But as you can see, that takes place in isolation from all the other issues around the value chain. It's going to result in very significant job losses without uptake into the equipment that could be made made here to produce that machinery in that technology. So we need to be thinking about the side streams here if that technology takes root. Waterberg, my understanding of the Waterberg is that most of the mining licenses there are in the hands of small and medium scale operators, so those are likely to be small open cast mines. Kumba, Saro, who's sitting outside the GP, has got a very big stake there, so they obviously are still the big player there. And I think it's important, the problem with mining and mining R&D is you need deep pockets. So, you know, as we have smaller and smaller players in the mining industry, they have fewer and fewer resources to invest in R&D, so it makes the stakes feel even more and more important. Some of the issues in Waterberg is that we could be looking at whether we can extract energy from coal bed itself without actually mining the coal. So there are a number of, besides sort of the questions around mining itself, there are also questions about whether there are alternative ways of extracting energy from that resource, and we haven't necessarily given the research on it. Payoff to the CSIR, in terms of investment in research, I think it's without
clarity about where we want to go as a country and what is required, and that without the backing of both government and the private sector, we're not going to see tables. And I think that is the problem, because you're investing into a vacuum and hoping that what is going to come out will be taken up. Essentially, one needs to understand at the beginning what is required, so the research and the efforts are directed in that way, and so that are in fact taken up as they proceed, and there's a lot of, and there's interest in the research as it progresses. Countries that have been successful in mining research in recent years, in Australia and Canada, I mean, two of them, work very closely between the R&D institutions, the private sector, and government in looking at what their next steps are. And some of them actually have meetings every 6 months to see whether it still go or no go, because the research in itself is quite an expensive undertaking. So, you know, I don't think you guys can talk about take without looking at what the plan is. As I say, the immediate payoff isn't trying to just make sure that the aging infrastructure and the infrastructure is sorted out immediately. That at least means that one doesn't go backwards, but from then onwards one wants to go forwards into some plan. Titanium, I'm actually not sure why the CSIR is looking at titanium. It might have to do with the very special properties of titanium and the very special material needs. In the CSIR, we have a number of capabilities around building completely new processes, completely new materials in them. So I don't know, Johan, if you have specific insights into that.
Thanks, May. Maybe just to go back to the previous question, just in addition there to the potential taker, I fully agree with May. And I just wanted to say that I think in the short term, the payoff that you will get is, I think she referred to that, is improved infrastructure in terms of laboratories like the testing, the self-contained cell rescue rope testing, mechanical testing, proper sports facilities of safety related issues, etc. And maybe in addition to that, the other payoff you'll get in the short term is like a unit like maize unit, is to make sure that as people go into water work and other mining activities, that the post-mining and the broader environmental issues, etc., that you refer to, that they are addressed as part of that process. So that I would say is a kind of a short-term return to expect while there is this gap in terms of the national plan and strategy. Then maybe also just a point on the roadmap issue. I think there was a question who should lead it or. Currently the thinking was that through that task team that I referred to that is currently operational under the guidance of the DM, Deputy Minister Olifant, that stakeholders in that group requested CSIR to coordinate that process of looking at those existing three strategies with DTI, MinTech and DST or DMR and DST, and to convert that into a process to develop a CSIR, a national R&D strategy. By working together. So at this stage, the request was that the CSIR should assist with the coordination of them. Then the titanium, May is correct, the titanium resulted from activities through the CSIR's materials and manufacturing the materials unit of the CSIR, where they look at light metals and aluminium, titanium, etc., and a whole number of other technologies and processes. As part of that process of the advanced manufacturing technology strategy in the mid-2000s that I referred to, there was in the technology that was developed by the CSIR, which is a kind of unique technology, the standard technology for titanium processing in the world is the crown technology, and that is utilized basically globally. And the CSIR believes that we sit with the potential in South Africa to shorten the titanium metal production process, and that was then discussed, and that DST then decided to support through the CSIR the development